You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. It's been almost a week since brutal fighting broke out in Israel after attacks by Hamas and retaliatory Israeli airstrikes devastated the blockaded, densely populated Gaza Strip. Thousands of Israelis and Palestinians have been killed so far, and thousands more have been injured, displaced, or are missing. And the numbers are expected to increase as the fighting continues. Taking in the images and experiences from the region have been brutal, and they have been heartbreaking. The deadly events mark the latest phase of a conflict that stretches back decades. Two professors here at Sac State are organizing a roundtable discussion next Tuesday to help those who are hurting and to talk about the context and the nuances behind what's unfolding. And they join us now. Harvey Stark is the chair of the Humanities and Religious Studies Department, and Dr. Sahar Razavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies Center. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning.
First, I just want to check in, given everything that's been happening over the last several days, and just ask how each of you are doing. Sahar, I'll start with you.
It's been very, very difficult. We are all of us invested in some way in what's happening there, and watching the pain and the carnage and the suffering with this feeling of dread that it's only about to get worse. It has been all consuming, and Harvey and I were just talking about how powerless we feel at this point.
Harvey, how are you doing?
Yeah, I would echo what Sahar said and add that every day finds waking up, reading things, and figuring out how the cerebral, you know, the academic process that we go through, whether or not it's sufficient, but also feeling passionate about the need to educate and to help both the community, Sacramento community, but also our students voice their feelings.
Yeah, education obviously brings awareness. It also can help heal because people can have a better understanding of what's happening. When preparing for this conversation, it was hard for me to know where to begin. Where do you think we should start talking about this, Sahar?
It depends on what your objective is. If education and understanding, I think they can heal to the extent that they reduce a sense of confusion and maybe being lost. But still seeing human suffering is, whether you understand where it comes from or not, it's still going to be very painful. If we want to talk about, if the question is about where do we start with the history of how we got to this point, then we could probably start with the late 1800s and the beginning of waves of Jewish migration from Europe and elsewhere in the world to the region, to Palestine. And then from there, we have different milestones in the history that can help us understand what the dispute is based on, what the conflict is really about. And I think, not to get too far ahead in the conversation, but I think Harvey and I both have talked about how important it is to understand the difference between territorial and religious disputes, what kind of motives people have. These are all very important issues when we're talking about this crisis.
Historically speaking, when looking at what's unfolding today, how recent is the conflict that we're seeing play out?
Well, I think we can say that it's, again, going back to when we start, conceptually, we can talk about the colonial period, British interaction. Sahar, you mentioned the end of the 19th century. And so I think politically, this engagement starts there. We can't understand what's going on now if we don't understand the facets of colonialism, which are directly connected to aspects of the Zionist movement and the migrations that Sahar was talking about. If I were to think about the first part of the question, which is how do we start the conversation, I see it on two levels because here in America, we are here, right? We're not there. So for the people who are engaging with this conversation here, I think it's very important for us to educate them on the fact that there are very diverse opinions on either side of this issue, and there's a very robust conversation typically. And I think that should be heard by those who are on the outside of this conversation, no matter how passionately involved they are. On the other side, when we think about those living there who are facing this crisis much more on a day-to-day level, I think we have to not ignore the power imbalances and how they have to engage with those aspects of their own security, their own health. And so I think if we can, if those of us here who are thinking about it can bring those two things together when they think about the situation, those emotions that they're feeling about what's involved in this situation can be somewhat rationalized.
You touched upon the Zionist movement. For those who are unfamiliar, what is that?
So within sort of theologically in the Jewish scriptures and throughout history, there has been a messianic, so to speak, desire for a homeland. And that, like any other religious principle, is just that. It's a religious principle. But once it's activated through a political ideology, which was motivated in part by, and not just, but motivated by the a Jewish sense of insecurity, in particularly in Europe, and that combined with the conceptual idea of the nation state, which grew out in many ways out of the colonial period, those things created a sense that a state could become real for the Jewish people and a place of solace or refuge. And so I think if we want to break down a very complex concept to a few primary aspects, it would be the idea that there is a religious aspect, but that religious aspect it's animated by the political and the reality of needs.
So essentially, like, reducing this conflict to religion is a complete fallacy, because it is a religiously diverse area. You have Jews, you have Muslims, you have Christians, and more, but it isn't that simple.
Yeah, no, definitely not. If I reflect back on my students, what I try to impart upon them is that although religion is something that motivates and moves us on a day-to-day basis, it's animated by the circumstances and the context we live in. And so that in some part explains why religious groups at various points in histories live in relative calm, and in other points the religious elements are escalated or animated by economic or political conflict.
Hmm. Sahar, given that, you know, the power imbalance that Harvey was talking about, I mean, this is in recent history, within the last, you know, 75 years, what is important to know about the power imbalance that's taking place or that has taken place?
Well, the first and foremost, we have to recognize that there is a state that has it has all the trappings of a developed nation state, right? It has a military, it has a well-developed economy, and it also has the backing of almost the entire Western world. On the other hand, we have a stateless population. So in this case, we can talk about authorities and governments and elections, but Palestine is not a nation state. It has observer status at the United Nations. Although many, many countries in the world recognize it as a state, it is actually in fact not a state. So we have a state and a non-state, and we have an occupier and we have an occupied according to international law. And these are power asymmetries that are undergirding and perpetuating the conflict that we're seeing. And even calling it a conflict is itself controversial, because many people feel that the word conflict suggests that there are two militaries that are fighting it out. And it's simply not the case. Palestinians do not have, they don't have a military. They don't have control of their own airspace. They don't... Gaza, as you mentioned, is under complete blockade for the last 17 years. 50% of the population of Gaza is children. 2.2 million people in a tiny strip of land that's 139 square miles. It's about the size of San Francisco, one of the most densely populated areas of the world. In the West Bank and East Jerusalem on the other side, there are 580-some military checkpoints. Everything is... we have a separate, it's called, it's a wall, they call it a separation barrier, that has cantonized the entire Palestinian side of the West Bank as well, or the Palestinian side of Jerusalem and the West Bank as a whole. All of this is extremely not only disruptive, but it's a perpetual daily set of subjugation, humiliation that happens at the hands of, again, a much more powerful entity that has the backing of the most powerful nations in the world. So when we talk about this, that power asymmetry has to be part of the starting point of the conversation, because how we understand what's happening now is to a great extent determined by where we start the clock. And if we start it on Saturday, it's going to look a lot different than if we start it in 1948. And even that's not a good starting point. We have to start further back. We have to start with the winding down of World War One, the rivalry between colonial powers, the sort of machinations of the UK. I mean, we can't understand anything that's happening now if we only are going to pick the point at which we started paying attention. And that's why these conversations are so difficult to have. They require the awareness of a lot of very complex dynamics. And it's easy to lose sight, especially when people are in pain and scared. It's very easy to lose sight of fundamental asymmetries that are in large part animating and driving the crisis.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with Sac State professors Harvey Stark and Sahar Razavi from Sacramento State, and they're talking about the themes that are underlying the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and their upcoming roundtable discussion that they're planning to host next week on Tuesday night. As you laid out, Sahar, even using the word conflict is tricky. Words are so important. I mean, they're always important, but in this, what we're talking about, even omitting certain words, you know, is an issue. It is such a sensitive issue that can go back depending on when you want the starting point to be. That can be difficult when you're reading news articles and media coverage. How does the media coverage make you feel this week?
A lot of despair. lot of despair. I mean, there is media coverage, as you know better than me. It doesn't occur in a vacuum, and those power dynamics are certainly at play in what gets covered and what gets spotlighted, and whose pain is discussed in which ways. And there's a long history here as well of disparities in coverage. So it makes me feel very just powerless again, because we want people's stories to be told, and everyone's pain is valid when they are going through this kind of loss, and we can't ever deny anyone's humanity and pain, no matter what. On the other hand, we can't pretend that there aren't disparities in coverage. We can't pretend that the difference between saying that X number of people were killed and X number of people died makes no difference in the way that audiences understand the direction of power. So it's very difficult to watch this happening for me. And I'm not Palestinian. I can't imagine how much worse it must be, or Israeli. I can't imagine how much worse it must be for a Palestinian and Israeli to be watching what's happening.
Yeah, Harvey, yeah. I mean, it even goes on social media, too. I mean, it's not just, you know, the traditional sense of like a TV or a newspaper. I mean, this transcends that into social media.
Right. Yeah. And I think as academics, we can parse the language very well, and we can see the different sides. I often say, growing up in New York, I would, you know, being engaged in these issues, you would talk to either side, and either the New York Times was pro-Palestinian or it was virulently pro-Israeli. And I don't envy the media, because the parsing the words, even when Sahar and I have been deciding what to call the meeting, the roundtable at Sac State, figuring out who's going to participate, what words you're going to use to describe such that you don't escalate the feelings of those involved. We live in an environment where those words, the way the media represents them, can animate how people are reacting, what they're doing. So there's a great responsibility in figuring out how to balance those words and present them is obviously crucial, in addition to the fact that we know that people are reading media often in a bubble and they're getting a very particular lens on the situation based on what they're reading.
And the algorithms are only making that worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. And it even extends beyond the media, I would imagine. You know, what I'm learning from both of you, I mean, you can't be entirely objective about this, right? And even in academia, perhaps, you know, the way history is interpreted, you know, plays a huge role in this as well.
Yeah. And
no, go ahead.
Yeah. And academia has had strong power in this conversation. I mean, we see particularly during the neoconservative period, we have academics who were consulting Bush and other members of the White House on how to view the area and what to do in the region. So academia has an ethical purpose here. And I think we have to remember when we look at it that it has multiple ways of educating.
And access to education as well.
Absolutely.
Especially higher education.
Absolutely. Academia has a very long history of being complicit in the crimes of colonization and imperialism. And all of us who consider ourselves academics, we all have to grapple with that history and the ethical obligations that Harvey is talking about. So trying to expand access to higher education is a necessary first step. But we also have to be mindful of what that access produces, because if we aren't, then we as a collective body, academics, we can only, we can fall very easily into reproducing that same sort of complicity in the crimes of colonization and oppression.
What do you recommend if someone wants to learn more about this? Not only what to read, but also how to read, what to keep in mind when they're reading. What suggestions do both of you have? Sahar, I'll start with you.
I mean, I'll be honest, Vicky, the landscape of news right now is very fraught. There's a lot of interference and involvement by different state entities around the world. This isn't any one particular state. This is just the nature of the state. The state is heavily invested in making sure that it is optimizing its own kind of perspective and objectives. And so we all have to consume media with a very critical eye, and we have to be sure that we are checking ourselves when we are consuming any kind of news. Are we vetting this news? We can't overstate our own agency and power. We're not intelligence services of our own. We can't vet everything to the extent that we would like. But we also have to be cognizant. Are we responding in a knee-jerk way to news that pushes our buttons and confirms our own pre-existing beliefs? Are we engaging in what's called motivated reasoning? Confirmation bias is a serious issue. We tend to the things that we already believe, when we see evidence that confirms that registers much more heavily than things that would challenge what we believe.
Especially when we hang out with like-minded people.
Exactly.
As well,
yeah.
Right?
And that happens, again, the algorithm is making that so much worse. So we have to approach it with a critical eye. We have to try to diversify the sources, but we also don't want to kind of accept on their own terms the narratives of states that want to make us believe certain things. So it's complicated. It's not an easy answer. It's not an easy approach. And it creates a lot of moral quandaries when you're reading news. But we always have to question whatever we're seeing and, as to the extent possible, incorporate as many voices as we can.
Yeah, I would, given that my field is religion, in terms of suggesting things or the things I use to educate with, I do my best to choose sources that help students or others engage with the interaction between religion and politics, so sacred history and then contemporary politics, the way those two are interacting. For instance, in the situation we're seeing now, we can't forget that the religious zealotry and the right-wing political landscape, that alliance, we see that in our own country, but that alliance on both sides of this conflict is animates religion and it elevates the what people see as the toxic elements of religion versus the potential tonic elements that we see shift and vacillate at different moments in time based on how that alliance plays out. So I think as a remedy, the best remedy that I can suggest is finding sources, if they're not media sources, sources outside that speak to a reader and tell the story in a way that they can understand that interaction without monolithizing any particular perspective or ideology.
When thinking about, you know, the confirmation bias that is just fueled by an algorithm and, you know, we're all on social media, and just the divisiveness that we have collectively felt over, you know, especially the last several years, are both of you worried about the rise in there's already been, you know, hate crimes for lots of marginalized communities, you know, regardless of gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation? Are you concerned with this specific issue, the rise of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia?
Absolutely. Every single time something like this happens in the world, that we see a spike in anti-Semitic and Islamophobic acts, and everyone is on edge that feels connected to those two groups, right? Everyone is, as I've said, everyone is hurting. But also then this is only amplified when we see videos of people being, I saw a video of somebody in New York in her car yelling at someone else. I won't repeat what she said, but it was wishing violence upon them because of a sticker that they had on their car. That was a flag, right? So these kinds of things are only going to fuel more conflict between us. And the really sad part about that is, as Harvey referenced earlier, within all of these schools of thought, within each cause, there's a huge diversity of opinion. Not all Zionists think the same and have the same objectives. Not all pro-Palestine activists and academics and thinkers, not all of them conceptualize that the same. Within each of those groups, there's a huge diversity. And when we approach each other with an assumption of bad faith because of whatever we've assumed to be true without evidence, all we're going to do is accept this crisis on the terms of the most powerful people in the world who are making decisions without our input. I mean, that's really the crux of it for me, that ordinary people are getting hurt, being killed, being dragged into conflict that they had no say in. That's what armed conflict almost always is anyway. But in this case, especially, we have no say in this. They don't consult with anybody on the ground, the citizens who are going to be affected. Leaders make decisions. People get hurt, and then we all fight each other about it. And it only serves their aims. It serves the aims of the people leading us into war. So I really want to, yes, I'm worried. I'm also terrified at how this crisis may turn into a broader regional conflict with many different actors being involved. The United States' involvement, we're talking about Iran, Syria, Russia, all kinds of Lebanon, everyone, so many people now involved, so many states involved, and all of that is only going to amplify the pain and the fear and make us more likely to turn against each other, which breaks my heart and terrifies me.
And we have to leave it at that. Sahar and Harvey, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Harvey Stark is the chair of the Humanities and Religious Studies Department, and Sahar Razavi is the director of the Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies Center. They're discussing the themes underlying the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and they are holding an upcoming roundtable discussion on this issue next Tuesday night. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.